and welcome along, my lovely listeners, to the latest episode of Glow West, where we talk about sex, sexuality, and the body. Glow West is delighted to be part of the Tortoiseshell Network, and you can support us and Tortoiseshell via patreon.com/tortoiseshell. So we have another very timely podcast today, as we've seen many conversations in Ireland about COVID-19 recently, but often sex is missing from these conversations, and so are the experiences of sex workers. Here to talk about this and so much more, it's going to be hard to keep this under an hour, but we'll give it a shot, is the incredible Addy Berry. So Addy is an intersex and transgender sex worker, psychology student, researcher, tattooer, and a board member of both the Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland and Intersex Ireland. She was previously collaborated on an Eisner Award nominated comic book. She's owned tattoo shops and dungeons in both Texas and Dublin, and she also holds a black belt in karate and is a parent to both grown children and happily married to the love of her life. Addy, that is some bio. How do you even top that?
It's a short one.
Yeah. How are you keeping during this weird and wonderful time?
I'm on the waiting list to get tested. I'm pretty sure I've gone through all the symptoms of COVID, but you know, of course, don't know for a fact, but I'm getting my lungs back slowly. So sorry if I sound a little bit asthmatic.
That's okay. You probably sound like half the country by the time this podcast goes out, unfortunately. So
yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay, if we start at the start, at the beginning, as Alice in Wonderland says, so you identify as both trans and intersex. Can you explain what that means? Because I can see how that would lead to a little bit of confusion for people who mightn't necessarily know how those two identities interact together.
Okay, well, I mean, they are separate but overlapping things. Basically, intersex means you were born with atypical genitalia, somewhere in between typical male and typical cisgender male and typical cisgender female. So there's actually quite a lot of us, almost 2%, which is more than redheaded or green-eyed people. So there's quite a few of us, but I almost all of the time at birth, when we're born, they do a little more than flipping a coin. They basically measure, like I was a 5-pound baby, they measured my ambiguous genitalia and decided I was going to be a boy. And then that's what they put on your birth cert. I think almost a 50-50 shot. So of you identifying with the surgery you've been given. And so there's a lot of us that aren't going to. There's a lot of intersex people that I know and that I've met that are quite happy with the gender they've been assigned. Mine has never been a very good fit, really for anybody. I mean, I grew up with, you know, it's kind of funny. You live in a world where people are telling you that only men and only women exist. But, you know, I guess those guys haven't found out why it is they have nipples, you know, because we all start off as women, basically.
We do, in the womb.
Yeah, and a child, you know, my parents were big believers that there's only men and women, even though they had an intersex child that wasn't really physically either. And my childhood kind of revolved around me doing a terrible job of being a stereotypical boy, liking the wrong things, picking out the wrong clothes, asking Santa for the wrong things. And needless to say, we don't have a great relationship. We never have, really. So that's really, you know.
Like, in that generation in Ireland as well, to, you know, when we didn't talk about sex or the body or genitals, you know, in a very public kind of way, how do your parents even broach that conversation, I suppose, especially with doctors who are just keen to operate and that's it?
I mean, this is also when parents were happily dragging their children off to the Magdalene laundries because they got pregnant outside of marriage. So, I mean, yeah. And it's actually kind of shocking to move back to Ireland and see how much shame and stigma still exist. It's a little jarring after having lived in the United States for a while. Yeah. And it's not just in, I mean, it's not just in matters related to genitalia, but it's also it's in mental health. It's everywhere. I think if we didn't have the mental health stigma we have right now, for example, it would be a bigger outcry. People could be open about suffering from things like depression, which almost everybody does, anxiety, things like some everybody's got something going on. We could speak up about it and challenge the system that we have right now that's failing us. And that runs into other things too, like the fact that that this country, include as well as many others, are continuing to perform surgeries on intersex children that have no basis in medical need. I mean, we'll rightfully come out against female genital mutilation, FGM, because it's basically just a religious, unnecessary surgery that causes women a great deal of harm and discomfort throughout their life. But we are only really doing intersex surgeries for religious reasons also. There's no medical reason. It's just, you know, a Christian thing where we're going to have boys and girls, but that's not really how nature works. I was just talking to a friend of mine who's a biologist in Texas a couple of days ago, and I've forgotten half the terminology, but she's like, yeah, nature is rife with things that fall on either side and land in between, and I landed in between also. So
I was going to ask you about the surgery aspect, because I know there is a movement now slowly gathering pace of not doing the surgeries and having intersex not be positioned, I suppose, as a medical mishap or something's gone wrong, but actually as an identity in itself, you know, and that there's nothing to correct as surgery, and some people might be happy to live with that identity. Is that the case, or are we, I know there's a long way to go.
I mean, I'd say step one would be stop the surgeries until, I mean, there's such a outcry that's pretty disingenuous about the big rush for transgender surgeries. People are being rushed through. Like, I'm almost 50 and I can't access care. So I don't see three-year-olds being scooched up the line. But if I had an intersex child today, we would get that surgery very, very quickly. And that child can't consent. And I can't speak for everybody, but I've been left with a lifetime of issues on many levels. It affects me legally, affects me medically. So, like, for example, when I moved back to Ireland, I was suicidal after moving back, because I was kind of coming back to the scene of a lot of childhood trauma and whatnot. And I was referred to a pretty well-known psychiatrist. It's just by luck, that's the guy that I was referred to. But I was refused service in my late 40s all I wanted really was to get a handful of antidepressants, some SSRIs or something to ease me through into moving home. And but just because I'm intersex and transgender, I was told I had to get on the waiting list, and that was in 2017, and I'm still on the waiting list to even have that conversation. So, I mean, intersex surgeries. Yeah, I mean, the intersex surgeries happen immediately, but trans care is, for all intents and purposes, non-existent. So, I'd say the first step would be just stopping the surgeries until people can consent, because when somebody gets to a certain age, they might be like, yeah, I don't want ambiguous genitalia. I just want to be a boy. I just want to be a girl. I mean, then people can choose. And all we really honestly want is normality, to fit in. Nobody, there's not one kid in Tala right now that's hoping, and this is many, many years later, hoping, oh, gee, I hope I stand out like a sore thumb. I mean, you know, I'll see in the comment sections every once in a while. Yeah, and I I'll see in the comment sections, there's nothing wrong with them that a good kick in the arse won't fix. Well, I grew up trans in Tala, so I've had many, many ass kickings, and I'm still trans and intersex, so that's apparently not the course we need to take. It's not really working.
No, not the prescribed medical approach to the whole thing. Jeebers, yeah. And, you know, the joy of intersex was that it's so different for a lot of people. So there's so many different forms, and people might find out maybe when they're trying for a baby that they're actually intersex. Or that could be, you know, they might discover that they're actually infertile as a reason for that, or it might be discovered at autopsy as well. Do you think that there's recognition, I suppose, or education about all those different forms that being intersex can take?
No, there certainly isn't. A lot of people haven't heard about it. And I think that the reason these surgeries exist in the first place is to establish a binary that doesn't really exist in nature. It's about erasing the middle. It's, you know, so men are from Mars, women are from, no, we're all from the same damn place, and we're not all born into two neat piles. It's a little bit messy, you know. It's like throwing pennies at your sofa. They're not going to end up in neat stacks either side. There's going to be a few in the middle cushion, you know.
I like that analogy. That's an interesting one. Well, speaking of binaries, you know, you do so much work in relation to sex work awareness and sex worker rights and advocacy, and that's one area that we definitely have binary conversations in. So if you're in sex work, you're either empowered or you're exploited, and then where does everyone in the middle fall into those two polar opposites?
It's also binary in that there's the people we choose to acknowledge and the people we don't. Like in conversations regarding sex work, you very rarely hear male sex workers brought up because it dilutes the useful narrative. Yeah. The Liam Neeson's Taken narrative of the Aryan virginal girl in chains being led away. If we start talking about, well, here's also a 40-year-old man, that it dilutes that whole narrative, so it kind of gets ignored. And the same with trans sex workers. But it's in recent conversations with the PSNI recently, we were talking about basically about how the more likely you are to be marginalized, the more likely you are to end up in sex work, and therefore also less likely to turn to the police, and that's a problem. It's a problem really for the police and for sex workers. But
so if you're marginalized like that and not viewed as part of the conversation, then how do you access services? You know, if the services are only geared around female victims, you know, for the use of the word that those services might use, then where do male sex workers and trans workers go to get help?
HIV Ireland, I think, do a pretty wonderful job reaching out to male sex workers here. I don't really honestly know. I know there's some pretty powerful, very well-connected NGOs here that seem to receive a lot of funding, and I can't for the life of me figure out who they help and how they help, because there's a serious lack of transparency. That we, while running on fumes, are in contact with trans workers, male workers, and a lot of female workers too. So I don't really know. I'm not really sure where women are going, because I mean I can't even get antidepressants, and I'm from Ireland, so I'm not really sure where trans undocumented sex workers are going for anything, really. It's possible they're using Women's Health Service. I'm not a customer there, so I couldn't tell.
So that's obviously a huge gap then for being able to assist people. And you know, it's obviously an issue in the area when we have the current laws at the moment that we do have in Ireland. So the laws around sex work are due to be reviewed this year. Do you want to explain to everyone what the impact of the current laws around sex work have had on sex workers in Ireland?
Yeah, it hasn't been great. I mean, again, it's hard to talk about things in isolation because nothing is in isolation. So we have the most recent change was the implementation of the Swedish model of client criminalization, which outlawed purchasing sexual services. But sexual services doesn't just mean you're having missionary sex with somebody and giving them and they're giving you money for it. It could be they're providing. I mean, bear in mind, we've got the worst housing situation probably ever in Irish history. If you were sleeping with somebody for rent, that would count. Or even they're buying you food or services or whatever in exchange for something that could be deemed sexual. So, I mean, for example, like in Portland and Austin and a few other places, there's cuddling rooms where, I mean, nobody's getting naked. There's a service provider in pajamas in what looks like an IKEA bedroom. And you go in and you basically just cuddle for a little bit. And I think with our history and our stigma and all that, that would be a lovely service to see proliferate here. But that would follow these laws too. So basically, the client criminalization was brought in. Also, street work was destigmatized. But the earlier laws, 1993, or was decriminalized, sorry, definitely not destigmatized.
We wish it was destigmatized.
I wish everything was here. But it's unfortunately, stigma here is very, very useful for a lot of people in power and it's very profitable for certain folk here too. In 1993, they passed the Sexual Offences Act, which brought in brothel keeping, which basically banned sex workers from working together. And these laws kind of work together, as well as other laws that banned advertising and things like that. So we live in a world where a Gardaí can work together for safety, but vulnerable sex workers have to work alone. And we saw this last June when two young women, one pregnant, who are 23 and 25, were sentenced to 9 months in prison solely for the crime of working together. There was no clients there. There wasn't very much money. The judge pointed that out, and he knew that they hadn't been trafficked. But he told them he didn't feel sorry for them because nobody made you do this. But when you look at what the people have said that basically pushed for these laws to come in, they were saying that nobody can consent to sex work because you're doing it out of economic reasons, so therefore you didn't consent, which really applies to everybody in every job.
We all have to work for money, right? Just different forms for everyone, so we all have to keep a roof over our heads.
And not all jobs are suited to all people. I mean, there's a lot of disabled sex workers who you can't expect to stand for 8 hours behind a counter or load shelves, but here's a thing they can do. And maybe they're on disability, but this adds to the money they make on disability and so that they can survive. And it's not like everybody's pulling in a fortune from sex work, you know?
Yeah. But even if they were, you know, even if, you know, it doesn't really matter, I suppose, what the money is. The fact of the matter is everyone should be safe in their job, you know, regardless of how successful you are at it.
You would think. I talked to somebody a while back and I tried to use the analogy of waitressing, and they got really mad at me we're pretty friendly now, so we've moved past this, but I use instead the analogy of construction. And in construction, everybody's anti-trafficking, but a lot of those orgs will freely admit that about 40% of the people who are trafficked end up, or 40 to 50% end up in construction or manufacturing. And if you were to come out now and say, okay, we're going to ban construction, it just wouldn't happen, because there's a lot of money in it, and it's not stigmatized. People who are consenting to work in construction could just stand up and tell you to shag off, either make our jobs safer or go away. But I mean, as a child, I mean, we owned a construction company. My dad did, my family did, and because I did a really poor job of being a stereotypical boy, I was made work construction throughout my childhood. And in that, I've ended up having to get fingertips reattached, my scalp reattached, almost lost an eye. It's a very, very dangerous job.
But
meanwhile, I've been involved in sex work on and off for most of my life, and I haven't. The biggest threats I've personally found from sex work have been really from law enforcement. I mean,
quote from Stoya, the porn performer, and she said, you know, something about sometimes a stonemason will injure their back at work. In my job, sometimes they injure my cunt, which is, you know, you either like that quote or you don't for some people. But yeah, that idea of the body in labor and how we actually expect people to work under capitalism and use your body and get injured and not have support there as well, I suppose.
I mean, I was working with a guy, I was in Florida this time, and we were nailing up hurricane straps. And this guy had an eye patch, and he was on the ladder next to me. And I was like, hey, do you mind me asking what happened to your eye? And he was like, this. And I'm like, well, maybe he shouldn't really be doing this. And he goes, what's the chances it's going to happen again? And the next day I got hit in the eye with a nail. So I found a different job. But it's a very dangerous job. But there's no stigma with construction. So basically everybody can stand up and be heard. But in the stigma is particularly bad here. Like, even though it's fully criminalized in America, we had a very strong community and people are happy to speak up and about it. Like, my wife is a sex worker also, and she has, her family are largely conservative, but they're aware of what we do and they don't really care. They're pretty accepting. Whereas even people who would be considered very much on the left here, they kind of act like you told them you eat babies or something for a living. They just act horrified, you know, and shocked. And I really would have hoped we'd move past that, but no, alas, no.
Yeah. And it's very divisive in politics, especially people who would claim to be, say, women's rights activists. And, you know, they're either pro-sex work or anti-sex work or, you know, critical of it as well. So, yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, it's funny how that stuff works, because it's a bit like, you know, I don't know, like if you had a village with a source of water that was less than desirable and you had people drinking from it and you were worried about their well-being, you wouldn't cut off that source of water. And for a lot of people in sex work, we're seeing it now, like the people are in dire straits because, like, I mean, me myself, I don't have a lot of savings because I was evicted by Gardaí. There's a lot of people in the same situation as me and a lot of people scrabbling right now when they're basically their source of income has gone away. And this pandemic is really highlighting a lot of problems. Like that this is, we should have had affordable housing all along. And it shows now with the government action they've taken that they could have done this. But you would never, in that village scenario, just erase that source of water. You would provide other alternate, better sources of water. And then you will greatly reduce the amount of people drinking from that source. And there might be still one or two people doing it, but 90% or whatever have moved on to other sources of water and they're doing better. So if we're providing alternate sources of employment for trans people here, like in America, they have the Witness Protection Program, which they made work by... the government contacted lots of different companies throughout the country, and they agreed to work with the government in exchange to basically hire people and make that work. Well, we've got Google here. There was, what, $14 billion in taxes? I mean, they could hire a few trans people to sit in the back and teach them coding, you know, and give them a wage they can live on, some transferable skills, without coercion, of course. But yeah. I think we can hire people, but it seems like it's just as about sweeping things under the carpet. It just seems to be the Irish way, you know?
We're so good at that here, especially when it comes to sex. Like, you know, the whole thing of Ireland didn't have sex until we had TV, which, you know, is obviously ridiculous. But the idea of, like, we're good, you know, possibly religious people who don't engage in that kind of filth. You know, and that it's been persuasive. That's the word. That's not the word I'm looking for. Insidious, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's been persuasive too. I mean, the stigmas, it's 2020, and we're still, if I speak up, people will say you're not typical. Well, the thing is, it's kind of funny, when outside, I guess outside of sex work, you're kind of given an idea of what attractive is, and it's a cisgender person who's 18 to 25, cisgender male, cisgender female, and they both live at the gymnasium. And the further you get from that, the less attractive you are. And when you're in sex work, you kind of realize it's kind of a beautiful thing, but you realize that literally everybody's attractive and we come in all shapes and sizes, and there isn't really a typical. We're just like everybody else. We're just human beings and boringly normal.
So, well, speaking of boringly normal, most people don't own dungeons, or the majority. Maybe the world would be a happier place if more people owned dungeons.
Well, some people would be happier.
So, yeah, I said there's probably a lot of politicians that would be clients, I would imagine.
Well, there's definitely talk to me about spanking. So.
Yeah, definitely. Talk to me about what it was like to run a dungeon in Texas, which, you know, you're in Austin, right? So that's slightly more liberal than the rest of Texas.
It is, but Austin's a funny place. It's kind of a little oasis. It's a liberal oasis in the middle of a pretty conservative state. So you still, I mean, it's not like there's a wall up that keeps people who are conservative out or anything like that. So a lot of our clients were conservative. I mean, you know, you'll be finishing up a session and they'll be telling you what they think about Black people and trans people and gays and all this. And we're like, wait a minute. I mean, like, I remember what we just spent the last hour doing. So, you know, but it was good, really. We had a really good community. I mean, there still is, I think, a pretty good community there. We could work together for safety. We didn't have to worry about working by ourselves and ending up being evicted, even though it's fully criminalized. The level of fear here when laws have been put through to supposedly protect people, the level of fear here is so much higher, and the levels of stigma and all that than in America. But I don't know. I mean, it's like anything. You have your good days and bad days. There's a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of healing work done in a dungeon. I mean, you're
yes,
hurting people, but you're not harming them. So, I mean, for example, we had people who were high up in the military who we'll salute them all day long while they're putting their life in danger or flying overseas and bombing the hell out of babies from other countries. But if anyone found out that they wear panties in their private time, their life would be destroyed. So some people would just, military would just come to do very little more than just dress up and hang out for an hour. And it sort of says a lot that we were like, oh, what a hero. We salute you for going bombing the crap out of people. But, you know, that you're not that rugged behind closed doors. They would probably lose all of their friends, family, marriage, everything. It's a kind of crazy world.
It's an interesting. Yeah. And it's fascinating how, you know, I've heard that from a lot of sex workers about like the healing aspect of the job, and sometimes it's more just about, I suppose, listening to people and nurturing. But you don't get to those conversations if all you're talking about is trafficking or you know, violence, I suppose, and you're not looking at the positive side of things. So we have very stifled conversations about it, I think, that miss those nuances.
Which is kind of funny, because the people who are silencing it and diverting the conversation are also pushing for laws that have consistently shown a big rise in violence. Like Sesta Fosta brought more violence. I mean, I was sitting with friends in America when that went through, and they were getting texted by old pimps right there on the phone going, hey, here's my number, you know, and that's what we were seeing. And Sesta Fosta had one, it highlights how disingenuous the whole thing is. I mean, on one hand, you're passing these laws to stop trafficking, but meanwhile, you've got 20,000 stolen children in cages that you're trafficking. So you clearly don't care about trafficking, and you don't care about sex workers, and neither do the people pushing the laws here. I mean, you can see it right now during the virus. The people who push for those laws, I don't see them having any fundraisers. I don't see them, they get a lot of funding. I don't see them opening their wallets and helping some people out with rent or food or anything else. But every sex worker I know is out there rallying to try and get money, raise money. I mean, it's literally how our whole week has gone, is just basically battling back and forth and trying to get something together, which is out there now on social media. We've got our Sway fundraiser going. But it's just like, as a, I don't know, I don't know that I'm right about this, but I'll endlessly theorize on it. But as a child who was beaten myself, because basically in 1970s Ireland, I don't know what it's like for an intersex child now. I'd imagine less stigma. But my mother was basically horrified that she'd had an abomination, and our house was a den of iniquity with me under the roof, and she wanted it gone. And I was just, it's not a wow, 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 my mummy didn't hug me, but my mummy didn't hug me. And she, you know, so I was, you know, I was a beaten a lot. And I think I've noticed in clients that come, because it's not like you're going to go punch them in the kidneys or something and cause them damage. You're spanking their bum and you're not doing it. You're just making their bum red and sore. That's all you're really doing. It's kind of theater, really. You know, that they'll come and ask for the whole cake. You gave them, you give them a slice of the cake and tell them they ate a much bigger cake, you know?
Well, the concept of consent comes into play.
Yes.
You know, they're consenting to that beating, which obviously as a child you can't.
Yeah, as a child you can't. But it's weird too also that for a long time this country, I mean, we were in primary school, I think this teacher's still there as far as I know. If we didn't know the sermon, we were lined up and she went along and punched us in the head with her big ring. And that's okay.
Teacher's been fired.
No, I think she's still there as far as I heard. It's people don't really care, you know. I think we're all beat. No, so it's just sort of like, well, yeah, well, whatever didn't kill you. I don't know what the but it's funny though, because you find out that some grown man consents to getting spanked by a middle-aged drag queen, and people lose their mind, you know. It literally brought the
But do you think that's a moral thing?
Oh, it's absolutely it doesn't affect you. It's kind of like I'll see these guys comment on posts with their trans children. There'll be some trans kid in National Geographic. These adults are never going to meet this child, but they're losing their mind because, damn it, that kid's room is pink. They should be a boy. Make them get a haircut and pretend to like football. It doesn't affect you. It's crazy, but it bothers them. And I don't know why it bothers anybody that somebody might want to get spanked when we, in the Ireland that I grew up in, we were definitely okay with children being beaten. But I noticed with a lot of these clients that they will come maybe agitated, stressed, afraid, and they leave just, I don't know, much just happier with a spring in their step. And it's possible. I don't know how you test this ethically, but it's possible that maybe as children, there's a bridge built. When you should have gotten love and affection from your parents, you sort of built a bridge with pain or humiliation instead. And now as an adult, you find those things soothing when you really shouldn't, but it is what it is. You know, it's a lot easier to just not fuck up your kids to start off with, but you know, all we're doing is putting out fires at this point. Then there's also people who just enjoy it and think it's fun. And, you know, I'm not judging those people either.
Is this your psychology work coming into play?
Well, it's funny because I've also tattooed for a long time, and we always said in the shops that they should just give us a psychology degree.
Yeah.
But no, apparently they don't give you one. So it basically takes moving back to Ireland, being refused service in mental health care, and then getting a degree your own damn self. You know, so that's how you get the psychology degree, I guess. So I'm on the last legs. I'm on exams next month, and then I'll have at least my undergrad. So.
Oh, fab. Well, best of luck with that, and hopefully they're not cancelled because of Corona.
They're online, and I'm not really sure how that works, which is just like, I'm a weirdo. Maybe I'm sure it's because of my childhood. I don't know. But I like a lot of the things that other people don't like. I get really excited for exams. Like, I know I'm supposed to not, you know, but like, a lot of things.
We're very different people.
I don't like sports, but like, I was getting, so I'm actually like, there's a few things that like, our poster conference was cancelled, and I was so excited to talk about my undergrad research and hold up my poster, and I'm really proud of it. And I don't get to do that now, and it's just like, damn it. And you know, and I'm all about that. I guess I'm a nerd. I don't know. Like I was pretty excited about sitting in the big exam hall and having those 2 hours, and then I like the challenge. And now it's just, I don't know, just uncharted territory. I don't know. Weird.
And what's that, will you go on to do a master's next, do you think?
Yes, that's my goal. I've applied, I know you're supposed to apply for a million of them, but I found one that suits pretty well, I think, because I want to bring, I want to continue doing research. I think it's important. It's one of the reasons I got into this, because my life has been, my medical history has basically been ruled by pretty shoddy biased science, you know, the works of Ray Blanchard. So I think then also, like we saw when these laws were coming in, I mean, they wouldn't allow sex workers to speak. They said that we had a financial interest in this whole thing, which is crazy, because if we're going to pass laws on farming, well, you can't let the farmers talk. They have a financial interest in this. I mean, that's not how anything works, but you get away with it when you got sex workers.
Very hypocritical.
Yeah. And so I think it's important to, well, on one hand, there is no evidence that backs up any of that. Like, I was sitting talking with Senior Gardaí recently, and we were talking about the numbers and just kind of going over the fact that there is literally no evidence to back up any of the laws that have come in. All of the laws fall on the other side. Like, all of the, like, Northern Ireland is the only Swedish model country that has research from before and after. And the laws, the research all shows what we support, but it's important to continue doing that research in the hopes that somebody's going to listen to it. I mean, these laws got pushed through with no research, which is kind of what my undergrad thesis was about. But yeah.
Well, no research on that side. There was, they ignored research from groups such as Amnesty and the World Health Organization, said that these laws actually cause harm to people and put people in danger and aren't actually that effective. And they actually spoke to sex workers, like you should do in any ethical research on sex work.
Except if you saw, I don't know if you saw that there was a paper came out in November that was acting, pretending to be a little more official than it was. I don't think the Justice Department were particularly thrilled, as far as I know. But it was from the High Working Group, and they came out with recommendations. And the group was, the paper was spearheaded, and the group is led by organizations that actually, it acts like it's a bunch of organizations, but its organizations are founded by the same religious orders. So basically it's religious orders and then some organizations they founded. But this, amongst the suggestions were, you should definitely give our sister organization more money because all of the services and the exit services, because the thing is, I want exit services to exist. I'm a sex worker. If you want to do sex work and this is something that particularly fits you, I want you to be able to do that. Also, anybody that doesn't want to do it, because it's not always great. Sometimes it's freaking gross. I don't know. But it's just, I want everybody who doesn't want to be in it to be able to get the hell out and do whatever it is they want. Yeah. But for those things to happen, we need to be able to provide, like, it's been a battle to pay. It's kind of what today's conversations on the phone were about. It's been a battle to pay my way through school. And if you don't have rich mummy and daddy that are willing to pay your way, and a lot of us, like a lot of trans people like me, for example, I don't have any relationship with my parents. And so them paying my way through school isn't really a thing that ever would have been. And I don't know how many, hopefully that's not the situation as much. I know it's a little bit of a better Ireland for trans people now, but I know it's not perfect because I'm dealing with the health service here myself. So, or lack thereof.
But
I mean, when I'm out on the street doing outreach, I don't know what they're spending, but I'm seeing two police officers per sex worker, and I don't know what that costs, but maybe we could take that same money and pay tuition for all of the girls that I see out on the street and put them through school. I mean, when I go to school, I'm sometimes the only person there. I'm sitting in an empty classroom. There's a lot of empty seats. I don't see the harm in letting them sit there, maybe with pay to get their exams graded. I don't see that it should cost as much as it does. I mean, divert some of that money into college tuition for some of these girls and let them work their way into healthcare. There's such a stark divide, and that's part of the reason we're being failed with our health services. Why I'm constantly meeting people that are being turned away when suicidal. I talked to a young man there recently who showed up suicidal and was told to come back in 9 months. I mean, that's when there are organizations that are being given literally millions to help suicidal people, but you're being turned away if you're more than moderately depressed. And from my perspective, all I can figure is maybe it's they don't want somebody dying on their watch, but when that person does die, they want to point them and go, look, that's sad, give us more money, which is kind of what's happening in that High Working Group paper. They're like, oh, look, this is terrible. Girls are doing terrible. Workers are doing terrible. There's no exit supports. But y'all are the ones who are supposed to be providing them. You were paid to provide them. And they're like, well, yeah, we should definitely give more power to the Gardaí and more money to these same
organizations. How does that work? If you get a charge for brothel keeping on your criminal record, like how, you know, that's obviously going to come up in Garda checks when you're trying to get a new job outside of sex work. So how on earth is that meant to help people?
Well, I have been asked that, and I'm still looking for answers. There's workers that I've talked to, street workers, who they will come and take that information. And we know there have been incidences where a woman has called the police, and it wasn't sex work related, but basically she was the victim in this case. But her name ended up on some kind of a list, and it resulted in her, because her name was on that list, it didn't specify that she's a victim, and she ended up being denied housing over it. And I talked to workers who are worried about where their name goes. And if our whole goal is to get people out of sex work, well, them having a criminal record that says they're a sex worker, something that's as heavily stigmatized as it is, isn't really going to help with that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know, like, you do really good work with SWAY. So for anyone who isn't familiar, SWAY is the Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland. And you do really good advocacy work as well with sex workers. And I know last year you had your art exhibition, and that was for the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. Am I right on that?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that's an annual day on December 17th. So talk to me about art, because you do seem like a very artistic, creative person, especially with the tattoos and, you know, and a lot of your life choices, I suppose, seem very, use art and creativity and different methods to communicate. So tell me a little bit about how you decided to use art to raise awareness of that subject.
Well, I've always, there's not a lot of things that survived my childhood. A lot of the things that I was naturally drawn to didn't happen. Like, ballet lessons were not in the picture. Baking was frowned on. Knitting was frowned on. All these things were considered too girly. I'm trying to learn to knit now. It's going with so-so. I'm trying to pick it back up now. But the one thing that's really kind of consistent is art, where and when I could. And it's been sort of a pressure valve, and it's really allowed me to survive and help me process a lot of things and get me through. When you don't have the words for something, you can draw a picture, you can draw an angry picture, you can draw a sad picture, you know, you can draw something that makes someone giggle, I don't know. But it's, it's, as a kid, I couldn't drag anyone I knew to the galleries and the museums as a kid, but I spent a lot of time in it. And I used to look up at the paintings and the portraits, and I'd be just blown away by the craftsmanship. And these days, I look at it a little bit different. I sort of see it as like it's been kind of acquisitioned away from us. And rather than it being this phenomenon that people do in order to survive, it's become, in a way, part of the problem. You go to a museum and you're like, oh, look, these people are important. There's a painting of them. Well, they paid for the painting. And then the person who painted it, who has those skills, they weren't growing up in Tala. They weren't growing up in a traveler's halting site. They weren't, like, you walk around the rich neighborhoods here, and Fitzwilliam Square and Merrion Square and whatever, there's a plaque on every damn house. And you can be kind of forgiven for thinking rich kids are brilliant at stuff, you know. This one's a poet. This one's a painter. But, you know, though, maybe you could do that in Tala too, but everybody's dealing with the multi-generational effects of child abuse and dependency issues and not having the resources. Like, we don't all get to all hang out and write poetry, you know. So even now, I don't get to draw and paint a lot. I wish I did, because it's good for my, I can actually feel it in my brain when I draw. Mm. And whether I turn out an absolute piece of nonsense or not, which I often do, it's kind of irrelevant. It's important to get that stuff out. And so these days, rather than see this amazingly painted portrait in a gallery, I would rather see angry napkin drawings by sex workers, to be honest. Like, I mean, we don't have mental health services here if you're poor or working class. And this is where most people in sex work come from. So you don't have access to these things. So I want... And a lot of people won't draw and they won't write because they're like, well, and this is what they tell me, that I'm not any good at it, or I want to draw, I want to paint, but I'm not any good. Who cares? The important thing is that you draw and paint or write your poem. And if your poetry is crap, write it anyway. Put it up on Instagram under a pseudonym, or don't stick it in a pile. Who cares? But nobody started off really good at anything. Everybody started off crap, and then you're less crap and less crap and you suck less and suck less until you suck less, you know? And so the way you get the first step is just bloody well draw. And I want to see, seeing as we are denied services here, we're denied mental health care in this country, and we need it. The pressure's brutal here. Like I said, I lived in the Bible Belt, and Texas is I wouldn't say is the most friendly place for trans people. I had guns put to my head in restrooms, pointed at me in traffic. I had somebody walk into my tattoo shop with a shotgun, where we had a very, very tense conversation at gunpoint over gender science. And luckily for me,
I imagine that'd be quite tense.
I'm a weirdo, like I say. There's really little things that kind of freak me out, and big things don't seem to. Like when I was in Seattle for a really big earthquake up there, and everybody lost their mind. People were trampling their friends and whatnot, and I was really calm during that. But I'll freak out. Like I'm working in a tattoo shop right now, and outside the door, somebody's put a sticker from something from the news agents right there on the handrail, and I'm like, why? And that's bothering me almost more than anything, and I'm aware it doesn't make sense, I don't know, maybe it's something to do with my wiring, because I've talked to with other friends who are victims of child abuse too, and a lot of them have said similar things. Are people with a lot of anxiety that when things are really terrible, they're completely calm. But when there's no reason, there's no noticeable or justifiable reason to freak out, we're freaking out, you know, and I'm kind of like that. So, I don't know. But yeah, there's up the road from my shop, there was a deer, an intersex deer that had been shot in the 40s, and I had a leg growing out of its back. And I was able to basically, I tattooed the firearm beside me, and he had a shotgun, and he was clearly there on a hero's quest, you know, to rid the village of the evil trans person that was going to run out and eat the children or whatever the hell his pastor told him.
And, whatever you do with a trans person.
Yeah. In reality, we sit and knit badly while watching Netflix, but well, speaking for myself. But I was basically like, yeah, I'm a lot like, I'm pointing a gun at him, he's pointing a shotgun at me, and I'm like, you know, this is how I die. You know, I'm going to get blown away in a tattoo shop in Texas, which is, I don't know, it's a little metal, I suppose. I don't know. But
just a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, he knew of the deer up the road. And I was like, well, I'm like that deer, except I don't have antlers or a leg growing out of my back. I still have a photo of that deer on my phone because it saved my life. But kind of forgot where I was going with that.
I don't know. I was just like really into the drama of this scenario with the shotgun. Jesus. No, yeah, but the idea of art, I suppose, that's a thing, but using art, the sex workers, you know, the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Work or sex workers.
Yeah, I think that art has a, as well as being a very useful tool for people to break down barriers, like as well as helping us through mental health issues, it's a useful way of transcending where a poem or you know, just after I got done saying people should write poems, but like where a speech or whatever isn't going to get the word across, maybe an image will. And aside from that, we need to be doing them for mental health reasons. But I throw a lot of stuff against the wall, and sometimes nothing sticks. But I got a pretty good response from sex workers all over the world that I set for the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. I wanted to market by basically just showing art from sex workers. And I didn't want to, like, this has to be all art of you doing sex work. I kind of wanted to show that we're just kind of normal. So we really did. We just got, it wasn't, some of it was about sex work, some of it wasn't. Like, I wanted to make sure it was okay to just send a picture of your cat or a fish or whatever. And people kind of did. And people sent poetry. Then a young, wonderful lady flew over from Spain, and she'd done a bunch of cartoons that explained the horrors of the Swedish model pretty well, I thought. And she's actually a really amazing fashion designer.
Oh, cool.
Oh, hey, Lilu. She's really amazing, just amazing, gifted person. And There was a lady came over, Victoria came over from London to read really breathtaking poetry. Another lady came from, a young American worker came from down the country somewhere and read. And it turned out it was a really good night. And people sent films and things, and technology failed us. So we do plan to show those movies again, hopefully.
Yeah, that would be great, because it's a great way to have the conversation, because sometimes in the media it's very stifled, or it's, you know, you might have two people on debate and one is pro and one is anti, and they just fight each other, and it's like, that doesn't actually lead to any kind of good conversation.
Well, that's also it's a problem, because I encounter that in my school too, and I've been encountering it, that it gives the impression that it's an even level playing field, and it isn't. Like, if we're to have a debate about Rice Krispies and cornflakes, who gives a crap, you know? But when we're talking about, like, you see this a lot with the trans issues, and like, for or against. And the thing is, somebody gets up there, you know, like, you've met me, I wander off a little bit. You put me against somebody who's a really experienced debater, as opposed to somebody who has a fear of speaking and a lot of anxiety and things like that, like me. What if they annihilate you? Is there no rights then for sex workers? And that kind of tie our trans people, and that we just saw that recently with the We Don't Buy It campaign. That public money was used to pay for an opinion poll. And so just say, for example, I mean, actually half the people polled said they support us, which is more than I would have expected, especially when other crowd are paying for. But just say nobody supported us, then what? Like, we don't deserve rights? And you see that with the, oh, you know, you lost the debate, so therefore we're going to start rounding up trans people and extinguishing. I mean, like, we freaking exist. We've always existed. Intersex people always exist. So you can argue, and I, you know, I do it less and less. I like my bubble more and more. It doesn't really go anywhere. I haven't got enough life left to sit there and argue with every Trump supporter. It's like, doesn't matter what you say, it doesn't matter what you send them. Like, look, dude, I'm a freaking
expert. You're not gonna listen.
We've always been here. Well, I don't think you exist. I mean, you believe in God, and there's no proof of that. Like, I don't exist. Who's right in front of you? But because God, who there's no proof exists, said so. You know, but if we're all made by God, well, then this is how God made me. I don't know what to tell you. You know, it's just ugh.
Yeah. That's a deep philosophical conversation to be had on Twitter.
And then when they present it as the for and against, it's not equal, because, like I said, most people, I mean, I ended up in sex work very, very young because my home was not a safe home to be in. And so I started basically going home with other people and meeting people up, and I had an ad out at one point, and I did some pretty unsuccessful street work. But that's what drove me there, was my vulnerability and basically being marginalized. So you're going to take somebody, and there's a consistency on the anti side that a lot of these women are middle class, upper middle class. They're basically around a bunch of rich bitches, and you got them on one side, and somebody who's basically just scrabbling to make ends meet. They're not getting that nice NGO salary coming in. They're just scrabbling to get by, and it just. Well, this person who's been to college and been on a debating team, and versus this person who was probably homeless at an early age, and so on and so forth. It's bad to frame them like that but I guess it's what you do when you've got no evidence on your side. So
that's one way of doing it. Okay, we might start wrapping up there, but I really want you to give the link to the hardship funds we are running at the moment. So do you want to talk just a little bit more about that, and then give where people can donate as well? And where can people find you as well?
I'm kind of all over the place. I'm on Twitter as Adeline Whitney. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, all those good places until they kick me off.
You're pretty all over the place.
I'm pretty all over the place. But let me get the fundraiser. If you go onto Sway Ireland, SWAIIRELAND, You'll find us. There's a hardship fund through causefox.com. And we're working at, I mean, we basically just got it up. We were debating for a moment going, do we want to add to the stigma against people who are already just trying to squeeze in whatever work they can before we're being isolated? But, you know, we have to respond, you know, and there are very... We don't have the resources that the others do. There's very few. I mean, there's just not a lot of people who can be open about it. I mean, that's what I was saying to the Gardaí, you know, that when they were basically quoting the anti's numbers and going 80% and 90%. You can't count accurate numbers for sex workers when if we can't all stand up and be counted. You can't tell us what the percentages are. I feel like I have responsibility because I'm kind of quadruply stigmatized. I'm intersex, I'm transgender, I'm a sex worker. I suffer from depression at least, and so they can't take my kids. My kids are grown. They've already evicted me. So you know there's not a lot they can do. The only thing they can do is hurt my wife, and they already did that. They almost drove her to suicide over the eviction. So. I mean, and my wife isn't alone in that. I've talked to single mothers who are evicted, and I don't know who that's supposed to make better. I mean, that's the thing. A lot of police are actually clients, and our culture celebrates clients. We had that Monto song that was very popular for a long time. There was about an area where there was girls in locked up in Magdalen.
Yeah, the Dubliners, I think, was it?
I like the Dubliners, but I always hated that song even before I knew what it was about. But we celebrate that culture. I mean, we have that, the Sunday World, you know, with one hand pointing and ogling, another hand pointing and shaming, you know, and making money off of it. And,
well, my friend Kelsey, who's a porn star in America, she writes that people point with the left hand in judgment and they masturbate with the right at the same time. So
that's perfect.
Yeah. Element of that as well.
Maybe that should be our national logo. I mean, we need a statue of that up on O'Connell Street. And at least until the situation changes, maybe we need a statue of that up on O'Connell Street.
That might work. Well, you know, you're the artistic person to do that. So there you go.
Sculpture isn't my forte, but as soon as I get through exams, maybe I'll start. I just need to locate a large block of marble.
We can figure that out. We'll
chisels.
Yeah, we'll go up the mountains. We'll get our chisels and we'll get there. Addy, listen, it's been fascinating talking to you, and I could literally talk to you for about 3 hours and we still wouldn't even be anywhere close to the depths of your knowledge and experience and your awesomeness. So
you're awesome.
Listen, I really appreciate you come talk to me, and you know, you're doing amazing work, and please keep it up, and everyone can hopefully follow you on social media and donate to the fund as well, and bring you a bit of marble down the line to make your statue.
The pointing, awesome. Masturbating Irishman. Thank you so much, Caroline. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Addy. Thank you.